Hello and welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm your sometime host, Baron Soka. I'm here in lovely San Francisco with the NBA All-Star of Surveillance. According to Senator Ron Wyden, that would be none other than Jennifer Granik. Jennifer, welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast.
Thank you.
Jennifer, you've had a long career in this field. You were at the Stanford Center for Internet and Society from 2001 to 2012.
Basically, 2001 to 2007, then I took a break. I came back in 2012, and I was there until the middle of 2017.
And in between, you were at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Right.
And you also somehow managed to find time to write a book called American Spies, Modern Surveillance, Why You Should Care and What to Do About It, winner of the 2016 Palmer Civil Liberties Prize. What's the thesis of the book?
The idea of the book is to show how lots of changes, particularly in law and technology, have made massive surveillance the rule of the day, and to talk about how that happened and what we could do to roll that back and try to get back into a situation where surveillance is targeted for good purposes and not massive for indiscriminate purposes.
And good work. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
And this year you just joined the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project.
That's right.
As the Surveillance and Cybersecurity Council.
Yes.
So I'm sure you have no shortage of things to work on now. So the Nunez memo that everyone's talking about seems like a perfect teaching moment for thinking about FISA. Many people are hearing about this for the first time.
Right.
Foreign intelligence.
We're bringing a whole new category of people who never cared about FISA before into the folds of people who've been worried about FISA for decades.
You mean Republicans?
I mean Republicans, yes.
So
welcome, Republicans.
Yeah, so how about that?
About FISA.
Now, let me just point out that so many Republicans, many people are just hearing about FISA for the first time, but there was a major provision of the act that came up for renewal last year, and Republicans all voted for that. So at the time, and maybe you can explain what that was about, but
yeah.
At the time, Republicans, they were not arguing for being more careful about surveillance. The political dynamics were the opposite, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, particularly when you have FISA reform. So we had a law which allowed for warrantless targeting of foreigners overseas. And we had long suspected, but it was validated by disclosures from Edward Snowden and subsequent reporting, that this law was resulting in collection of vast amounts of Americans' private communications. And we learned that those communications were being repurposed from foreign intelligence purposes for regular run-of-the-mill crimes. And the FBI could search those and is searching those communications without a warrant. And so this was a real concern. The law expired, was set to expire in December of 2017, and this was a great opportunity for reform. And it turns out the reform isn't necessarily partisan. The progressive wing of the Democratic Party and the libertarian wing of the Republican Party came together, as we often do in these surveillance matters, and agreed that there needed to be reform to make sure that the surveillance was more targeted and that there was not room for abuse and that kind of thing. And it was the mainstream Democrats and the mainstream Republicans who joined together basically to defeat that reform effort and to renew the law with some cosmetic improvements and some things that were promoted as reforms but may even make the law worse. And that happened just a short 3 weeks ago in the middle of January. So we had these mainstream Republicans and mainstream Democrats, and those Republicans included Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy and others, who basically just said, don't worry about this warrantless surveillance. We are sure that the oversight that happens in the intelligence community is working perfectly fine. And that's one of the reasons why it's so painful for those of us who wanted reform to sit here now and see them complaining that FISA is being used in an abusive manner. They're talking about a different provision of FISA, one that's actually much more privacy protective and has much more safeguards in it, but they're complaining that that's being misused it's just hard to understand how you can say, don't worry about this warrantless surveillance when they think that warranted surveillance is totally out of control.
Okay, so last year was, that's Section 702.
Right.
Right, and that's the foreign persons thing. We did a show on that. We've done several shows on that. We'll link to those. And then we had, of course, Section 215 back in 2015.
Right.
That was renewed with some reforms in the right. USA Freedom Act.
Believe it or not, that's going to come up again in about 18 months.
Oh, hooray. So what provision are we talking about now?
Well, with the Nunes memo, we're talking about Title I of FISA, or what we sometimes call traditional FISA. And this is basically the provisions that were passed in 1978. And it plans for a warrant to do foreign intelligence surveillance. And the warrant is based on probable cause, but unlike a traditional criminal warrant, it's not probable cause that a crime was committed, but probable cause to believe that the person being surveilled is an agent of a foreign power. And you have to write an affidavit and go to a judge who's been appointed to the FISA court, which is this court that meets in secret, but a judge who's a Article III regular judge who's been appointed to the court, and that judge has to find probable cause, sign off on the warrant, and then you're required as a government agent to come and report back every 90 days. So Title I of FISA is the most privacy protective part of FISA because it involves judicial review and probable cause, even though it's of a different sort.
Whereas the other part of FISA...
Whereas 702, the other part of FISA is no warrant. And really no judicial review of the people who are being surveilled or the selectors used to surveil them. And no real, the court approves procedures for handling the information once it's collected. It approves minimization procedures, but the standard for approval is pretty light and it doesn't really involve itself. And certainly once the information goes to the FBI, the court's not involved at all in searches that take place there for criminal purposes. So it's a warrantless surveillance scheme.
So before we unpack the Nunes memo, point being that everyone signed off last year on the really problematic warrantless surveillance, and now we're having a frenzied argument about the part where a warrant is actually required. And the Nunes memo alleges essentially that the government, in surveilling the Trump campaign, when they made their application to get that warrant, that they withheld critical information, and therefore the entire investigation should be considered the fruits of the poisonous tree,
right,
and discarded, and Trump should get out of jail free card.
Yeah, basically. And I mean, the thing that's so upsetting about that is, you know, just from a surveillance policy perspective, is for that to happen, it's like the DOJ has to be corrupt, the Attorney General's office has to be corrupt, the FISA court judge has to be remiss, and then it's multiple FISA court judges that have to be remiss. So all these layers of oversight that we were told to trust in the warrantless surveillance context, they're saying totally failed in this more rigorous warranted surveillance context. And that's just, I mean, it's not, if you really believed what you were saying about the Title I warrant and Carter Page, it just doesn't make any sense that you would vote to renew Section 702 without severe reforms.
Okay, so unpack for the audience just a little more, what exactly is the Nunes memo alleging?
So the memo, it's 3.5 pages, and basically it has some cherry-picked facts from the Page affidavit, so the affidavit that the government submitted in order to get a Title I FISA warrant to conduct surveillance of Carter Page. And it's basically saying, I mean, the main core of the complaint is that the government did not tell the FISA court judge that some of the facts that were the basis for the warrant were from this Steele dossier. And the Steele dossier was written by this guy who was hired by an organization that was paid to dig up political dirt on the Trump campaign and on Carter Page and other people associated with the Trump campaign.
And side note, while ultimately that work, the Steele dossier work, was paid for by the Hillary campaign, it was originally started by a group of Republican anti-Trump people in the primary, which also gets left out in this conversation.
Yeah. So it's this political machinations. But the main idea is that, and what Nunes said is that, you know, this was information that the court relied on, and the court was unaware, or the judge was unaware, that it was basically hearsay and innuendo that was paid for by political opponents. That's the claim.
How would we know if the judge really had been misled?
And the only way really to know is to look at the affidavit in its entirety.
And that's not public.
That's not public. In all the years since FISA has existed, a affidavit in support of a FISA warrant has never been made public. Not only hasn't it been made public, no criminal defendants who've been charged after being surveilled under FISA have ever seen their warrant applications. This is just something that, while you could have discovery of it, in practice, it's never happened. The government has always claimed that national security interests outweigh the or make it too dangerous to disclose the.
So Nunez is asserting that that the judge was misled, but we don't really know whether the affidavit said this is all about the Steele dossier, or this is only partly because of the Steele dossier, and we don't really know how the Steele dossier was characterized.
Correct. We don't really know any of that. We have like some reporting that kind of has been hinting. One piece of information that I think came out today was that, and I can't remember whether it was Trey Gowdy or Nunez who agreed with this, that there actually was information in the affidavit that said that the Steele dossier was was funded by a political opponent or had political motives. And they said that was in there. It may not have said from the Democratic National Committee, but it was in there that it was political motives, but in a footnote. So there's just, and we also know that these affidavits are in support of the applications in support of the warrants are often many, many pages long. So like 30 pages, 70 pages, they can be quite long. And the Nunez memo is only 3.5 pages. So it's just a few pieces of information from what's definitely going to be a much longer piece of data. It doesn't really make sense because the application and the warrant were renewed on a number of different occasions. I think it was 3 different times.
So as you said,
after 90 days, you get the renewal. Yeah. And in order to do the renewal, our understanding is that you can't just rely on the initial bed of facts. You have to say to the judge, okay, we've been spying on this guy for 90 days, and guess what? We're finding stuff. It contributes to the probable cause. You have to say, here's the stuff we're finding that contributes to probable cause that they're an agent of a foreign power, and then the judge will sign off for another 90 days. Because if you spy on somebody for 90 days and you get nothing, then the judge is like, well, maybe you were wrong. He's not actually an agent of a foreign power, so I'm cutting off the warrant. So there's information coming in, apparently, at different points along the way that contributes to the finding of probable cause, which lets these 4 different judges and different people in the Attorney General's office sign off on it.
So each time it's a different judge?
I believe they said each time it was a different judge.
So
you get whatever judge is on the wheel. Like somebody is up and that's who you get.
So in other words, there's a lot of reason to think that there were lots of facts here that led to the government thinking that Carter Page was an agent of a foreign power well beyond the Steele dossier.
Right. I mean, one piece of information is our understanding from public reporting is that they were looking at him back in 2013.
Far before the Steele dossier was
Before the Steele dossier, before he was associated with the Trump campaign, like, you know, before anybody could have even imagined that there would be a Trump campaign or a Trump presidency, they were interested in him back then. So, you know, was that may well have been in the affidavit too, but we can't know. We don't know that. And the allegation that, well, you know, they suggest in the Nunez memo that there was no way for the judge to know that it was politically motivated, but they said it in a footnote. And, you know, we read the footnotes, lawyers read the footnotes, because that's where you put all the most important stuff.
So much ado about nothing.
It seems like there's much ado about nothing, but the result of it is actually really kind of a disaster because it has managed to, I think, translate into more mistrust about the process of FISA applications, about the process of the Mueller investigation, about the relationship between the Intelligence Committee and the Department of Justice, about Trump's relationship with his Attorney General's office and people in DOJ, about other countries who are our intelligence partners sharing information with us.
How does that relate here?
Well, here you have, I mean, talk about the disclosure of the memo, right? The FBI and the DOJ recommended against disclosure. It was the committee, the intelligence committee, voted to disclose along partisan lines. And here we have information that has traditionally never been seen before. And we can talk about whether that's good or bad, but clearly being disclosed for political reasons and for a partisan reason, not for a legitimate reason that there is really, that the memo really makes a case that Carter Page shouldn't have been under surveillance, but for political reasons to kind of throw up dust and sort of try to point the finger at the Mueller investigation and say it's somehow illegitimate. How can intelligence partners or anybody really have faith that when they share information with the United States, that it's not going to be disclosed for a partisan, political, invalid reason if this is how, this is the process by which we end up declassifying things?
Well, Trump was already going to tell the Russians anyway, so.
Well, I figure if he's going to tell the Russians, at least we get to know.
So on that note, this has really made people think long and hard about transparency. I mean, both of us and many civil libertarians have always wanted there to be more transparency about foreign intelligence surveillance and intelligence generally. That's why people were, whatever else they may have said about Edward Snowden, they were happy that at least that information about the scope of surveillance got out.
Yeah.
Have we been hoisted on our own petard?
I mean, I would say politics makes strange bedfellows. Because, you know, here we are, people who have said, we need to know more about how FISA works. And in this, like, really twisted way, we're starting to learn more about how FISA works. You know, just today, the House Intelligence Committee voted to disclose the Democratic memo, which is a rebuttal to the Nunes memo. And then the former Attorney General Mukasey has said that, like, the entire application for spying on Carter Page should be revealed. And the New York Times filed a lawsuit demanding declassification of the Page affidavit now, so, and warrant application, so we can see what that actually is. This may well be the thing that gets us to see our very first FISA Title I application for a warrant. And it's in the context of this, like, political disaster, but at least we're going to get to have some idea what the burden of proof is and how seriously the applications are written, and, you know, we'll know more about it than we did before.
So in other words, seeing the document that goes to the court will tell us what how much scrutiny the courts really give, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court really gives those affidavits in the future.
Yeah, at least in this case. I mean, this case is kind of a one-off in some ways because it is so political. But yeah, it'll give us some idea. How long are the applications? What kind of additional information do they require before they renew? What level of proof is in there? How many informants what do they exactly tell us? I mean, if we're going to end up about the informants, if we're going to end up seeing it. So we may end up learning more about this particular, you know, type of FISA. And then I think it calls into question the decision to keep all those FISA applications throughout the ages under wraps, because if this one can be revealed without harming national security, then what about the ones in criminal cases from the 80s and 90s, for example?
So do we need to change the statute?
Well, the statute allows for the people who are affected by the surveillance to ask to have the materials unsealed. But it has a standard which says, well, if national security interests outweigh the interest in disclosure, then that rules. And what's happened in every case is that the government has said the national security interest here is too important to allow the application to be disclosed, even just to defendants, never mind to the, you know, in the course of their criminal prosecutions, never mind to the public. I just want to say, like, very few people get charged with crimes as a result of FISA investigations, but there's some small subset that do, and then the defendant wants to know, was there really probable cause for spying on me? And the answer is, well, we're never going to show you what we told the court, so you don't get to find out.
And the probable cause in that case, would that not have to be probable cause of criminal activity? Would the probable cause standard for being the agent of a foreign power that's generally applicable for FISA suffice?
Yeah, the standard would be probable cause that you're an agent of a foreign power. If you are a U.S. person that has criminal elements to it, the definition of agent of a foreign power is related to criminal activity. But once that surveillance is accomplished legitimately, anything else that they discover that's a crime, then they could charge you with. And the government says, well, it may not have been what the, it may or may not have been what we were originally spying on you for. But if it wasn't what we were originally spying on you for, it's okay because that information was lawfully collected and now it's in plain view and we don't have to get another warrant for it. We were already legitimately eavesdropping on you, and so we can use that information.
And isn't that troubling that the foreign intelligence, the lower bar for collection of foreign intelligence, could be used to circumvent the Constitution's, the Fourth Amendment's protection
it
in
is,
criminal cases?
It is troubling. And it is troubling because you have this lower standard, this different standard, and then it's basically like a little bit of fair game. And since foreign intelligence surveillance is much broader than criminal surveillance is, there's just a lot more information that's taken in about people. But people have felt comfortable with it in the Title I warranted FISA surveillance context because there is a warrant, there is probable cause. The definition of agent of foreign power, at least for U.S. persons, is related to criminal activity, even if it's not that you're proving probable cause that there's a crime.
And what does that mean? I mean, how likely is anyone we know to be charged with that sort of crime?
Well, you know, for example, if you're an agent of a foreign power, one part of the definition is like you're working for a foreign power and those activities may be connected to criminal activity. Like it's vague there, but it can't be something that's like First Amendment protected activity. It can't be something that's purely legal that has no kind of, if you're a U.S. person, it can if you're if you're a citizen of another country, but it can't if you're a U.S. person. So people have sort of accepted that accommodation, and courts that have considered it in the FISA Title I context have said it's okay under the Fourth Amendment if you have this legitimate FISA warrant to gather information for a criminal context. And some courts that have reviewed it have said it was okay. Civil libertarians don't agree with that. The place where it really gets outrageous is when the surveillance is without warrants altogether. And you have this programmatic surveillance of foreigners overseas collecting massive amounts of information of Americans talking to those foreigners, as well as Americans talking to each other for like reasons of technical collection. And then that information is warrantlessly searched or data mined or whatever. And that's what's happening under Section 702. And that's why we're so upset about
those were the concerns that we raised in the fall that
yes.
Devin Nunes and other
and
Republicans
Adam
ignore.
Schiff and and Trey Gowdy and the mainstream Democrats, Adam Schiff, Nancy Pelosi, ended up ignoring.
Now let's note here that Trey Gowdy, now this is a Republican congressman from South Carolina, former prosecutor himself.
Yes.
He's come out and defended the FBI.
He has. And you know, this is again, politics makes strange bedfellows. Because in my book, for example, I am, you know, critical of Trey Gowdy because he was the one who told us, you know, back before the Snowden documents, not to worry about Section 702 because it has absolutely nothing to do with Americans. And of course, we learned that it has everything to do with Americans. The program is designed to capture Americans' international communications when we're talking to foreign targets. That's what the program does. So I'm very critical of Gowdy, and yet here he is in this case saying, you know, this memo isn't what Nunes says it is. And really the reason to listen to Gowdy in this case is because what the reporting is that Nunes actually never saw the application for Carter Page's warrant. It was Gowdy who saw it. And Gowdy basically wrote the memo or gave the information to Nunes, and Nunes is the one who packaged it and pushed for its release. But it was Gowdy and maybe Gowdy's staffer, or maybe Gowdy and Nunes's staffer, I can't remember, but those were the ones who actually saw it. Nunes never even actually saw the underlying affidavit at the point that the memo was released.
So
was written, yeah.
He really doesn't actually know what he's talking about. He's purporting to talk about the way that the judge was misled, but he doesn't actually know what the judge saw.
Right.
Astounding. What about overclassification? What does this whole experience tell us about secrecy in government?
I mean, you know, with the memo, the Nunes wanted it released, and they consulted with the White House consulted with the FBI and with the Department of Justice And both entities said, don't disclose it. This will harm our national security. That is the claim that's been made in every single case involving disclosure of FISA Title I applications since 1978. And it's the justification for keeping secret lots of information about surveillance today. That, you know, we can't let people know what we're doing because then they'll be able to circumvent our surveillance methodology. And, you know, we end up finding out things are classified, and it seems like they're classified for all kinds of, you know, all kinds of reasons that are something less than national security, like to hide the fact that a program that's legally questionable exists. So here in this case, we have a situation where they basically said, don't disclose this warrant. And the FBI went through this unprecedented, or at least very rare situation where it issued a press release saying, if you disclose this, it will harm national security. And Trump just disclosed it anyway, agreed to declassify and disclose it anyway. Well, you read it and you just sit there and you just wonder, why is this a danger to national security? Almost every piece of information that's in that memo is something that was publicly reported about Page already. And so it just really, the whole thing just makes you feel, A, why are things classified to the extent they are and to the volume they are already? This is not dangerous to national security for us to have read that memo. It just isn't. And what other things are being you know, sort of hidden from us with that justification? And the reason why that justification is so powerful is nobody can second guess it. The judges don't have clearances to do it. It's extremely hard for Congress people to get clearances, have staff cleared, go to the SCIF, find out what's going on, talk with each other. That's like extremely difficult to do. So we just have this assertion, one-sided. It's top secret. We know because we have clearances and people follow along and stuff stays out of the public eye. Stuff like this, it doesn't need to be classified. But then the thing that's the second part of it that's so upsetting, I think, is the idea that the classification will be just tossed away the minute somebody's political friend is in danger. Whereas, you know, people who are being charged criminally, people who are being spied on with no good reason, people who are, subject to political investigations, or we'll just never know because you just wave your hands and say top secret national security, and that's the scrutiny you get.
So how much hope do you have that we will out of this get a less hypocritical, more consistent and balanced conversation about privacy on both sides, both that Republicans will maybe be more consistent in realizing that there are real concerns here? And also, you know, there's a lot of hysteria on the left, a lot of people who've demonized the intelligence agencies who maybe might think twice now, might be a little more careful in noting that mostly the agencies are trying to do the right thing and maybe they have too much discretion. Maybe we should find ways to cabin that. Maybe there is too much secrecy. But they're not bad people.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have, I guess being a member of the left, you know, in the demand reform side, our rhetoric has, you know, may sometimes be sort of hot, but nobody believes that everyone inside the government is bad or that it's, people are just lying for political purposes. Everybody believes that generally the system needs checks and balances, and that's partially because power corrupts and partially because there are sometimes going to be bad people who make bad decisions, but not at all because by far the vast majority of people who are in the government, in the FBI, who are asking to do the surveillance are bad. Not at all. It's just that they have a particular one-sided perspective because that's your job and you need to balance that perspective with judicial oversight and congressional oversight and that kind of thing. So I actually don't think for the reform movement that there's a lot for us to learn from this in terms of, you know, people being, you know, people in the government being good. Although I do see, I think, some kind of on the left, like sort of blind knee-jerk acceptance of, you know, FBI statements or DOJ statements. I think it's important for us to remember you know, this is a, you know, that we may agree with the decision here, but big picture, these are problematic, you know, there's problems. And on the side of the surveillance defenders, I mean, I just think this is like, this is one of the most hypocritical things that you could do. It's, if you really believe that the system is so corrupt that this affidavit got by the by FBI, by DOJ, by judges, then you, there's no way you could have voted to ignore serious surveillance reform before. And you just see the rhetoric on the part of people, you know, sort of in the population is just really extreme. I think this is gonna, I fear that this is gonna end up giving Trump supporters more reasons and conspiracy theories to wave their hands at and say this is why the Russian investigation should never have happened. And I think it gives people who are against Trump more fodder to believe that, you know, the government and particularly the Republicans are kind of going over and above to try to protect him.
Although, again, we'll note that someone like Trey Gowdy has gotten off that ship.
Yes. He's not running anymore. I think he's
it
out.
Is, so. That is not perhaps a coincidence.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see what happens. So to wrap up here, so bottom line, just bullet this out. What do you want to see Congress change? And what do you think can just be changed at the agencies and at the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court?
Well, number one, we need more public disclosure. Like, I understand that, you know, each side is going to spin whatever for their purposes, but it's much easier to spin stuff when the facts are cherry-picked.
And what kind of disclosure? Like seeing those affidavits sometimes?
I think we should see the affidavits. Well, I think we should see this affidavit with appropriate redactions. And I think we should see affidavits other times too.
Okay.
There's far too much classification. And I think even the intelligence community knows that. That's why post Snowden, they've started to do more.
And second thing?
I think the second thing is we need to start taking surveillance reform much more seriously. We have another opportunity because Section 215, as you mentioned, is going to come up for a renewal in about 18 months. And, you know, we are learning a lot here about allegations, about misconduct, mishandling inside. We need to have a system in place that people can trust. You know, where really, really you can trust it, no matter what your political point of view is. And so we have to get serious about passing those reforms.
Do you think that conversation might, in some respect, be forced by the European Union? We've talked on the show before about the Privacy Shield, the agreement that allows data to flow between the US and the EU, and that depends on the European Union really doing these regular evaluations. I haven't really heard anyone talk about how this recent fiasco might color that assessment. Do you think there might be a connection?
I think absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of people who want the agreement between the US and the EU to work, because without it, businesses just fall apart. But the truth is, our law does not provide real protection for non-Americans from foreign intelligence surveillance, especially when they're outside of the country. So if you are outside, but your data is here, and you're a foreigner, our surveillance law does not protect you well. So I think here you have this idea of, like, you know, where the Europeans are told, don't worry, there's all this oversight, there's congressional oversight, there's oversight inside the intelligence community, inside the FBI, inside the DOJ, and this just makes the whole thing look like a disaster.
Well, the legal standard for them to continue renewing this Privacy Shield is substantial equivalence, which means that we have to compare how bad things are in the U.S. on national security with how bad things are in Europe. Do we really know how much more disclosure or judicial review there is over there to prevent this kind of abuse?
Well, you know, Europeans often suggest that their law is a lot better than ours on this front. And certainly I'm not an expert in the surveillance law and, you know, throughout the EU. But American law has some hallmarks to it that I think really stand out in comparison as being privacy friendly in comparison to EU surveillance law. And by surveillance law, I'm talking about like government access to information. A lot of countries' surveillance law does not distinguish between citizens and non-citizens, so they can spy on their citizens for stuff that's political in ways that we don't do or aren't allowed to do, at least here in the United States. We have judicial review for warrants, so an independent branch of government gets to look at the warrants. A lot of countries in Europe do
Although,
not
as
have
you noted,
judicial review.
If the judges don't have clearances and they have to rely on what the government tells them in the affidavit.
It's one-sided, but at least there's somebody there and it's not just the intelligence the head of the intelligence agency who's signing off on it. Theoretically, we have notice to affected people. That hasn't been effective, but we have that at least in theory. So there's a number of things that are features in our law, at least structurally. They may not be working well in practice, but you know, we could do more to live up to those. I think ultimately, you know, we're going to find out in relatively short time how the EU looks at U.S. surveillance law overall.
Any final recommendations for Congress?
Get it together.
Well, to wrap up, our new host, Ashkan Kazarian, our legal fellow, has been doing a segment at the end of these interviews called Women in Tech, just asking women we've had on the show about their careers. I think you're probably the dean of women in surveillance law, certainly among the ones we've had on. What's been your experience?
From a perspective of being a woman, you know, I've been, I think, pretty lucky in a lot of ways and very insulated as I read the paper and I see the experiences that women have had in various fields, you know, in Hollywood, in, you know, the hacker world, in tech companies. And I think that I got really lucky. I had a lot of great mentors, most of whom were men as I came up professionally. The work I did in the beginning of my career when I was representing hackers, there wasn't really anybody else who was doing it. I never got any kind of negative feedback or was compared negatively to anybody for being a woman. Maybe because there wasn't any guy to compare me negatively to, but I always had a, you know, I never had a difficult time with that. And I think that, you know, I have had a pretty good run of it.
So. And do you think that more generally that people take seriously civil libertarians regardless of their gender? You know, people who've worked on the other side of government.
Well, that's the problem. I think civil libertarians really have is the problem of being taken seriously. I think that there's you know, a real kind of concerted effort to sort of diminish the contributions of civil libertarians for either being you know, for being like, for complaining too much about stuff they don't know enough about, and that's just outrageous. I mean, you can look and see sort of the documented successes of civil libertarians in terms of getting FISA passed, in terms of having transparency and reporting, in terms of pushing the intelligence community to do more declassification, in terms of, you know, all kinds of things that have happened, and are the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, all sorts of things that have happened because civil libertarians have pushed for it. So I think there's just a real inclination to credit the views of current or former government officials over experts who are not current or former government officials, but who are in the civil liberties world.
Well, Jennifer, thanks for coming on the Tech Policy Podcast. Thanks. I'll remind everyone about your book. The title is
American Spies, Modern Surveillance, Why You Should Care and What to Do About It.
Sounds like a great read. Well, thanks again for coming. You can find this podcast on the iTunes store. Share it with your friends. Please feel free to leave a review. Certainly help others find the show. And Jennifer, we look forward to having you on again in the future.
Thank you.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.